Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. The job of the President of the United States has become too complicated, too unwieldy, too powerful, if we're going to be honest about it. That's the contention of John Dickerson of CBS News, our guest this hour. Dickerson argues that as a country, we've given too much to the person in the Oval Office and at the same time demanded too much of the person in the Oval Office. Dickerson says it's not only undermining our constitutional democracy, it's setting up our leader, be it Donald Trump, be it anyone else, for failure. This hour, On Point, is the presidency an impossible proposition? You can join us on air or online. What do you expect from the leader of our country? What's the most important part of the job description? What should we cast aside? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter or on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm delighted to say that joining me now from New York is John Dickerson. He's co-anchor of CBS This Morning. He's a contributing editor at The Atlantic. And he's here to talk about his cover story for The Atlantic this month that's headlined, "What If the Problem Isn't the President, It's the Presidency? The Hardest Job in the World." You can link to it at our website at onpointradio.org. Hey, thanks so much for joining me, John.
David, it's great to be with you.
So, John, take the appalling notion in your mind that I'm the president for the moment, and you're the chief of staff, and I've asked for my daily briefing, and I say, John, come on in here, give it to me, and you said, Mr. President, we're going to throw all the issues aside for the moment. We're going to talk about the nature of your job. It's impossible. And I say, what are you talking about? What are you talking about?
Well, you would say that the job's impossible, but you're stuck with it, which is to say that you know, obviously, it's not so impossible that nobody can do it because we have somebody who's in the job. So the question then is how to make it more possible, how to run it better. And then what you'd say to the president is focus on whatever your three things are that you want to take care of. And the big first one may blot out the other two, which is you've got to protect the, 370 million people in the United States. Here are a variety of threats that are immediate, like this morning. Here are a number of threats that are coming over the horizon. And so how do you want to handle all of those? And that's both a policymaking challenge and a staffing challenge. You, Mr. President, can't do this all. So who are you going to farm out to take care of and take ownership of these policies? And what systems are you going to ask us to put in place to deliver the best decision making to you? And then the secondary thing on that item list would be domestic prosperity. And you essentially do a version of that same triage and then basically say after that, Mr. President, somebody else is going to have to handle the rest of the things that may bite at you. And it's my job as chief of staff to figure that part out.
So despite the enormity, the enormous size of the government, I think you said 2 million employees and obviously a ton of folks in the military and beyond, this is a job that sort of is beyond the control of the president. How did it get to this point? Why do you think, John Dickerson, that this job is in some ways an impossibly unwieldy one?
Well, a number of different reasons that the job itself has gotten unwieldy. But let's just for a moment just talk about the number of people who work in the executive branch. So that's a result. So with complexity, and there's a wonderful new book out called Meltdown about studying complex systems and the DNA that is shared across all complex systems and the way in which even though complex systems are bedeviled by these possible catastrophic failures, because when things are complex, there's lots of domino effects. In other words, little problems can grow to be big problems very quickly. So that's what a presidency is like. And so you have to get a handle on it. The reason it's such a problem for a president is that everybody comes to the president. The more people you have in an executive branch, the more who want to see the president and get in front of him or who have ideas they believe should go in front of the president. If they don't get an audience in front of the president or don't feel like their idea has made it up to him through a proper decision-making process, then they leak to the press. Mm-hmm. Or they go out and they freelance and make U.S. policy without being vetted for all of the possible collateral damage and effects. So that's just the sheer problem from having more human beings involved in the process of the executive branch. As Joe Califano, who worked for LBJ and for Carter, said, there are just too many problems. There are too many people that bring issues to the president's neck, which I thought was a very kind of menacing way to put it.
Pretty pungent.
But for somebody who'd worked in a White House, it really crystallized for me you know, we can talk about the size of the executive office and bigger and smaller, but that's what it comes down to in a day-to-day process, is that there are just more human bodies in front of the president wanting more things, and there are still only so many hours in a day. That's just one slice of the way in which it's become more complicated, but it's a it's an important one.
Define there in the article, you sort of assign, I guess you could say, different categories or different roles that the president has to fulfill pretty much all at once. Just take a moment and tick through some of those roles for us, so that, you know, I think we're familiar with any president playing those roles, but we may not think about it in terms of the definitions of what that means.
Right. And one of the things the piece is about is, where do those roles that they've been assigned come from? How many of those roles are really a part of the job? How many could be shaved off from the job, and what would the cost therefore be? Mm-hmm. Because obviously this piece is existing in a context, and as much as I'm trying to talk about the history of the presidency, and the piece in fact started in the Obama administration, there is obviously a context, and the context is of a president who is challenging a lot of those traditional roles. But before we can carry down that, you know, some of the roles of president, well, he's commander-in-chief, so he has to deal with the defense of the nation, and we can talk about how much harder that job has become. He is also, though the founders didn't want it this way, the initiator and negotiator of ideas and policy with Congress. Mm-hmm. He is the national pastor, or has been in the past. This president has not really taken up that role, which is to say, he speaks in moments of tragedy, or he is in a sense a first responder, which is that he's not just speaking after a national disaster, but he is also, or we have come to expect, and again, this president has not embraced this part of the job, but have the president respond, go to the place where the natural disaster has hit, do things to improve the delivery of resources and aid from the federal government. He plays that role too. You know, and then there's the little stuff he's got to do in the symbolic importance of the job, which is, you know, do everything from host the NCAA volleyball team to pardon the Thanksgiving turkey. And then he's also got to do a lot of diplomacy, as we've seen in the last 3 weeks, with the president meeting the leaders of Japan, Great Britain.
I mean, it's
Japan, France, and Germany.
It's almost like going into Costco or something and trying to say, well, what kinds of products do you have here? I mean, it's a lot of different things. We have a couple of clips dealing with some of the things you alluded to from George W. Bush. First, I wanted to hear from him. This is what George W. Bush said on his first visit to Ground Zero. He was, of course, president at the time, 3 days after 9/11, while thanking first responders as New York City continued to smolder. The president grabbed a bullhorn and he gave these unplanned remarks.
I can hear you! I can hear you! The rest of the world hears you! And the people... And the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
And the same president, George W. Bush, giving remarks a bit later in his term in November for the tremendous privilege of serving as their president. He goes through this annual tradition that you alluded to, John Dickerson, a couple moments ago. This is a tradition apparently that his father, George H.W. Bush, is credited for starting, and that's of granting presidential clemency to a specific kind of being.
Recent weeks, I've talked a lot about sprinting to the finish. Yet I've assured these turkeys, they will not be trotting to their finish. That's because, in keeping with a long-standing tradition, pumpkin and pecan are hereby granted a full and unconditional presidential pardon.
So from the historic to the homey, you know, all these qualities, I guess, are supposed to reside in the same person, right?
Well, they are by custom, but there's nowhere that it is written that they must continue. And so one of the challenges in thinking about the presidency and also in evaluating our current moment is, because somebody does not fulfill a role, what is the damage? And in an overburdened office, there's absolutely a case to be made for paring down the roles a president must perform. But then the question is, which ones and why, and what does that leave other time for? Just because you're not embracing a duty of the office does not mean you're spending the free time constructively. And so that's all a part of the conversation. But, Yes, that's a pretty good demonstration there of the sort of span of presidential activity.
You know, it wasn't always quite this way. You have this hilarious thing early in the article where I didn't know this, where apparently I think it was James K. Polk's wife had a band play "Hail to the Chief" when he entered the room because she feared people wouldn't recognize the President of the United States as he enters. It struck me that, you know, there was not necessarily always the idea of this completely unifying figure in the same way. In the, say, minute plus that we have before the end of our first break, I wanted you to talk a little bit. Dwight Eisenhower emerges as something of a hero in the pages of your article, obviously the hero who led D-Day invasion. But as president, you say he set pretty commendable example. What did you mean by that?
Well, he thought about the job and talked and wrote and talked to his staff a lot about the job and how to do the job better. And so in a piece about the sort of the job and how to make it better and its structure, he becomes very useful. And anybody who's done any sort of personal time management knows the expression, don't let the urgent crowd out the important. That was an Eisenhower phrase, and it's a pretty good one for every White House. The problem with the White House now, and certainly in the age of post 9/11 age of constant worry about terror attacks, is that the urgent is always crowding out the important. And sometimes you spend your day simply trying to manage the urgent. You can never get to important. The problem is, if you don't take care of important or don't have a system in place to take care of it, then what was merely important and required tending to someday will become urgent. And by the time it does, you're in no position to manage it. And so it becomes an emergency.
We're talking to the great John Dickerson of CBS News, who, with about seven hats on his head, seems to be pretty good at time management. We're discussing the job of the president, how it's been transformed into a near impossible position and proposition. You can join our conversation. How do you think President Trump is fitting into the role? If you're critical, do you think it's his fault? Do you think it's the impossible's impossible demands? Do you think it's enemies in the deep state? You can mutter at your radio, or we'd prefer you just call us. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Hey, I'm Kelly McEvers, host of NPR's Embedded, and we've got a new episode all about how Scott Pruitt ended up running the EPA. It's a story about Pruitt's life in the Southern Baptist Church, how he handled a major pollution case, and why he sued the EPA 14 times. Just search for Embedded on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're exploring whether the job of the President of the United States has evolved into too steep a challenge for any one person to meet, regardless of who's holding the job. You can join the conversation. Do you think the demands of the presidency have set President Trump up for failure? Or do you like the way he's casting aside traditions in the Oval Office? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook on the interwebs at On Point Radio. I'm talking with CBS This Morning's John Dickerson about his cover story this month in the Atlantic magazine titled, What If the Problem Isn't the President? It's the Presidency. In this article, John, you talk about how there are moments at which sort of the presidency expands and checks on that person recede, and in some ways then expectations get overmatched. You talk about the Civil War, you talk about the Depression, World War II, and 9/11 as signal moments. But let's for a moment address the elephant and the pompadour in the room. Let's talk about Donald Trump. You know, to what extent has he exacerbated the challenges and the impossibilities that you define so ably?
Well, in a sense, again, how you look at this depends on kind of where you sit. I mean, he's decided that certain parts of the presidency he's just not going to participate in. And if you are a critic, you think that is an abomination. If you are a supporter, you think he's finding efficiency where presidents before him have not. But if we look at some of the traditional parts of the presidency that he is not engaged in, some of them would be after disasters, presidents usually feel an obligation to really monitor and stay on the case, and you know, certainly that was a standard to which George W. Bush was held. President Obama, after the BP oil spill, which is obviously not something the federal government had anything to do with in terms of creating the BP oil spill, that was a pre-existing condition that he then, the president, was on the hook for politically. Mm-hmm. And you compare, say, the BP oil spill, which President Obama was on the hook for, with the hurricane and subsequent devastation in Puerto Rico, which President Trump has, he made a visit. He makes some remarks now and again about it, but is not has not put his attention, certainly in his public and his Twitter account, in his is not one of his public obsessions. And it has not dogged him in the way, say, the BP oil spill did President Obama. Now, that could be a media thing, but it could also be that this president is off doing other things that are getting covered. But those would be that would be one way to look at the kind of disaster norms of the presidency as applied to two different presidents. President Trump has also not really been an active negotiator in any of the major legislation in a bipartisan fashion. He certainly had some opinions, often according to Republican lawmakers in public and in private. The president's changing positions on those everything from immigration to tax cuts to health care has actually made the job of putting legislation together more difficult. So the president, who came to office promising a special and unique negotiating skill to get Republicans and Democrats to agree on legislation, has really not even participated in that bipartisan kind of messy negotiating that we have expected previous presidents to participate in. Now, a critic would say he's not participating in a fundamental role of the presidency. A supporter would say, why should he get engaged in something where the Democrats aren't going to help him out? They're not politically going to help the president get a victory. So shouldn't he spend his time doing other things? And then I think there's the question of national unity. Presidents, even partisan ones, feel a certain obligation to speak and act and talk about national unity in a way just that this president does not feel as compelled about. Certainly, that was one of the criticisms after his response to the white supremacists marching in Charlottesville. But it's also just been more broadly, early in his tenure, people like Senator Scott from South Carolina, Republican African-American, mm-hmm. said that he would hope the president would make some trips into those parts of the country that are not his constituents, which is to say the president's constituents, the base of his party. But the president has pretty much decided to spend his time and attention sticking to the base that brought him in Washington. Supporters would say that's political smarts. Critics would say, you know, he's the president of the entire country and needs to show that even those who didn't vote for him are welcome participants in the American experience.
Let's take a call from Bill in Newton, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you, David. John, I have an interesting thought. Since Ross Perot, and I believe it was Clinton and someone else, I thought qualified in different areas to be an executive in the country, I thought that a triumvirate of leaders of the executive branch, one who who's designated to international affairs, one who is designated for domestic economy, and one for the domestic political arena. And of course, there being three, they could check each other. And because I think there's no checking on the executive branch, I think, and that makes it kind of not invalid, but not very progressive and not very helpful, for that matter, in dealing, for example, with the Congress, et cetera. So it's a new protocol, but I've thought about it for many years. And especially considering today, you're right, John, and seeing your program on CBS, there's way too much for one to be an expert in or to be very well versed in. So if the three people, whether, and I don't even think we have
so three, it sounds like it sounds like you feel the three is not a crowd. It's a charm. Bill, thank you so much for that. John Dickerson, in your article, you mentioned actually, I think it was former President Hoover came up with a suggestion in the 50s to help out during the Eisenhower administration. What did he think was the problem?
Exactly. This is one of the fun things of doing research. I was writing about the disaster relief and when that became a norm of presidencies. Eisenhower didn't have to do what presidents now have to do after a disaster. And on the front page of the paper in which I was reading about the disasters at the time, there's a piece that Hoover talks about having a vice president for administration. Hoover did twice, two examinations of the executive branch, trying to improve it and find efficiencies and ways to make it better. One of his suggestions was having a vice president of administration. So you'd essentially have a president and then two vice presidents. So what Bill says has a historical tradition behind it. I think the reason that people shy away from it is two things, I think. One, you have to have accountability, and a lot of people believe. And in the Obama administration, talking to officials from that, this had to get cut from the article. But they have a sort of complaint theory, a complaint window theory of the presidency, which is, sure, it's unfair that President Obama got blamed for not cleaning up the BP oil spill when he didn't create it. And again, this is a difference in the presidencies. President Trump says, why should we as the federal government be blamed for the slow response to Puerto Rico? This is the result of Puerto Rico's bad infrastructure and, you know, the exigencies of the specific Puerto Rico problem. Why should I be blamed for those? President Obama could have said that. Why should I be blamed for something dumb that BP did? That was not available to him politically. He was on the hook for it. And their argument in the Obama administration was, In an enormous country, you need to have one place that people can direct their complaints. You can't direct a complaint at the senator from Tennessee if what's happening is in Louisiana. And you can maybe direct it
There has to be someone at the top you can point to and say, what are you going to do?
And so you need somebody who's accountable. But what Bill describes is a version of one of the things I talk about at the end of the article when I talk about presidents who have managed the presidency well and talk to, you know, those who think about how to manage it better. And that's essentially handing over huge portions of what we expect a president to do to your cabinet agencies or to your vice presidents, and then build your White House around that. Now, there's a political challenge there. And it basically takes a good manager. And Michael Bloomberg on Face the Nation gave a great description of what a manager has to do, which is sometimes you have to hand over huge portions of your portfolio to a member of your staff and then trust them. And if something goes wrong, you don't say, well, that was that guy over there. You have to basically hang with them, even if they make a boneheaded mistake, because you need them to be loyal and working on your behalf the next time. And so the president stays as the complaint window, but still delegates in a really big way to members of his cabinet so that they can take care of a lot of the work that we expect presidents to do.
I want to touch on a couple of moments in the young Trump presidency that talks a little bit about the roles that are expected of the president. Here's President Trump when he visited Puerto Rico. You just mentioned that after it was obviously so devastated by Hurricane Maria.
You've thrown our budget a little out of whack, because we've spent a lot of money on Puerto Rico, and that's fine. We've saved a lot of lives. If you look at the every death is a horror. But if you look at a real catastrophe like Katrina, and you look at the tremendous hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that died, and you look at what happened here with really a storm that was just totally overpowering. Nobody's ever seen anything like this.
There was also the moment last August at a contentious press conference at Trump Tower. It was in the wake of the violence in Charlottesville, Virginia, where you, John, went to school. President Trump equated white supremacists with the people protesting against them.
I think there's blame on both sides. You look at both sides. I think there's blame on both sides, and I have no doubt about it.
You know, John, you spoke eloquently after that violence and after the white supremacist violence against the protesters there about what you saw and what you know you helped to report on. And yet it seems to me we have expectations of presidents in such moments, and that Trump, by a lot of people's account, really wasn't up to it. Perhaps in Puerto Rico, certainly after Charlottesville, even members of his own party criticizing and denouncing what he had to say there. We kind of do expect the president to be able to sum up what the nation is feeling and what it should feel in those moments. What do we do with that in this moment?
Well, we expect presidents to do one of two things, either to rush into the moment and help us make sense of it, help bring a country together, help apportion the reaction in a way that diffuses some of the fear, anger, worry, concern. If they can't do that, we expect them not to rile it up. And certainly in the comments about people on both sides, you know, as Senator Scott, in his conversation with the president about those remarks and also about the Civil War, said that there are no two sides in this debate. And if you're over debating that, you're really far away from what the central public moment calls for. Now, not every president has great skills in the public arena. It is a moment, and it is a thing we look for, because so much of our public life takes place in public now. And there's a part of the presidency that is very important that we never see. And that's a lot of what this article is also about, is we sort of overemphasize what happens in public. But there is a public role for the president to play. And so if a president is not particularly facile at speaking in those moments that call for something a little bit more pastoral, then that's fine. Not everybody's great at everything. So, but they...
I mean, it's sort of as though we're thinking about the head of state and the head of government are the same person. You look to England, you've got the Queen and her attendant descendants who can fulfill those roles as she enters her late years. We don't have that, right? We've got the president right. And maybe the vice president and their spouses.
That's right. And we do expect the president to play that role. So what a president would do who was not a gifted speaker by natural temperament is what, John McCain did, which is when John McCain campaigned. He's not a person from whom long paragraphs of beautifully connected prose effortlessly flow. So he had Mark Salter, a very good speechwriter and close aide, write some beautiful speeches that drew on what John McCain could say privately. The same was true with Ted Kennedy. Ted Kennedy had a very difficult time speaking extemporaneously, but he had people around him who could, Bob Shrum among them, who could write beautiful prose for the moment in this national politics where we do expect the oratorial skill. So that's one of the keys to a successful presidency is knowing what you don't know and then hiring people and entrusting them to help you with your weak spots.
I'd like to take a call from Tampa, Florida. Lauren, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Lauren.
How are you?
Doing great. What's on your mind?
So I'm wondering if the author felt this way about the presidency before the current administration and the current president, I hate to say took control because they haven't done that yet.
All right. He took office, the president. You're saying before President Trump, did John Dickerson feel this way? Luckily, I've got the one man who can answer that question. Don Dickerson, did you feel this way?
Sure. Yeah. And as I said, the part of the thinking about this piece started during the Obama administration. And again, how you interpret the complexity of the presidency depends on where you come from politically. And I don't know how many. Let's see. 6 years ago, I wrote a series of articles for Slate about the presidency and the attributes required to be president and how we might look for those in a presidential candidate. Some of that work and thinking is in this piece as well. So this started many, many years ago. And of course, this conversation has been off and on in presidential studies for a long period. The imperial presidency, obviously Arthur Schlesinger's seminal work, contains a lot of this idea. What I'm talking about in my piece looks at some of the things that have changed or accelerated in recent period, and that would be the national security challenges have multiplied. You have a Congress and a partisan situation that makes it harder for a president to have a willing partner in Congress. And then the speed with which communication now makes it impossible to have a kind of step back conversation that we're trying to have about this article. But also in any public question, the speed and pace of communications makes it much more difficult for a president.
You mentioned Congress basically receding from the field. I think you write that 9/11 accentuated that. That is that they said, hey, dude, you do what you got to do to take care of this. And while there were moments at which Congress intervened to sort of limit executive branch powers, it seems as though it's not creep. It's real gallop at certain moments in terms of the ability to exercise decisions, to do things without prior authorization abroad and the like. A lot of use by George W. Bush, by President Obama, by this administration on executive orders. Obviously, a lot of challenges in court we've seen in the Trump years. In about a minute left before we go to break, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the nature of a Congress having trouble reaching deals with the president, even when it's the same party that's in control of both, right? I mean, that seems to me pretty that seems pretty bleak to me in terms of the ability of the nation to function.
Well, that's right. And we have these battles with the president over the simple keeping the lights on, keeping the government funded. And this is a part of the growing partisan lock that both parties, but it's more prevalent in the Republican Party, have, which is that members are worried about the ideological challenges they'll get in their home
and
districts or states.
And in your writing, it seems to me it's not only asymmetrical, but it's asymmetrical in a way that is intramural. That is that although they're a liberal wing of the Democratic Party, there's a real strain in Republican circles that makes it very difficult for them to strike deals among themselves.
That's right. And we may see that come to in Democratic politics. That may happen. But right now, the Republican Party has wrestled more with these intramural challenges than Democrats have.
John Dickerson of CBS and The Atlantic and Slate and God knows what else. Please stick around. We're discussing how the presidency became a broken office. You can join the conversation. Do you think our expectations of the president are too high? That this job comes with too much power? Too little? Heaven forbid. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
I'm Scott Detrow. There is so much political news to follow these days, but you don't have to keep up with all of it. You just have to keep up with us on the NPR Politics podcast. You can find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. I'm talking with CBS This Morning's John Dickerson about his Atlantic cover story, What If the Problem Isn't the President, It's the Presidency. You can join the conversation. Do you agree with his argument that the job is simply too much for anyone? What would you do about it? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We have a commenter from our website, HelloKitty0580, I kid you not, writes, Obama may not have been perfect. He certainly made mistakes, but he held office for 8 years with grace, intelligence, humility, and thoughtfulness. Mr. Dickerson, he did it. He did it, and he did it well. Where are you getting all this from? I want to play a clip of President Obama.
I can tell you.
Go for it. Go for it.
Well, I'm getting it from many, many Obama officials, and this is a view the president and I talked about when I interviewed him on Face the Nation, and that he agrees with. It is possible to be president of a nation of 325 million people and find the job is impossible. It has parts that have grown out of shape and that need to be reformed. And so that's something that and they have a full list of things that you'd probably start with a Congress that is not fulfilling its role and not participating. That would be at the top of their list, which is something I write about. So.
But I would refer
you back to them.
Yeah, sure. In some ways, outside the scope of the president's ability, that is, that requires people to actually put their heads up above the parapet and take some decisions, right?
Right.
Up Pennsylvania Avenue.
Yes. And I think both presidents would feel that way about Pennsylvania Avenue. And the founders felt that way, too, that a little more risk taking and independence from Congress. Now, the minute a president would want that in order to have a willing partner, they would also complain, because presidents do like to do whatever they want to have unfettered power in the areas they want to have it. But in areas like health care and immigration reform, presidential actions taken either by executive action are limited and they get undone by courts, and they create this whipsaw between administrations that makes for bad policy.
I want to play a clip from President Obama from 2012 that in some ways cuts in both ways, both for and against your argument. Here's what he had to say at the Sandy Hook Interfaith Prayer Vigil in Newtown, Connecticut on December 18th of that year.
In the coming weeks, I'll use whatever power this office holds to engage my fellow citizens, from law enforcement to mental health professionals to parents and educators, in an effort aimed at preventing more tragedies like this. Because what choice do we have? We can't accept events like this as routine. Are we really prepared to say that we're powerless in the face of such carnage, that the politics are too hard? Are we prepared to say that such violence visited on our children year after year after year is somehow the price of our freedom?
And he offered similarly moving remarks after the slaying of people gathered for prayer at a historically African American church in Charleston, South Carolina. You know, that I remember well that speech that Obama gave. It seemed to me a moment of, in some ways, moving public leadership, obviously with some legislative remedies in mind. He's very effective at that in that moment with a Republican Congress, but also, I guess, a divided electorate. You know, certainly you could point to that and say, well, there's a president who really didn't get that much achieved on the public level, right?
Well, but I think he and all presidents recognize this by the end of particularly their second term. They recognize that there are some issues on which fighting the good fight and fighting the fight in public does something to change at least some minds or move the conversation down the field, that presidents are not a king. He was not going to get the legislation he wanted, but he can raise public awareness and he can hope to give comfort to those families and I think have some contribution, not all contributions short of total success are themselves a failure. So
that's right.
That's one of the, you know, constraints of the office. One of the difficult pieces of the office that you have to play this role. I mean, he had to comfort the families after that awful shooting. And then that equips you with a kind of deep frustration that you are this very powerful person who nevertheless can't do anything or do what you think would be a solution to keeping more families like that from happening, or in some ways trying to make meaning out of the awful tragedy those families had to go through.
You know, I think back also to 2012 when in Mitt Romney's candidacy, and you write about this, you know, really prepared seriously and hard for the idea of what if we win? What do we do next? And you say, in a sense, this is a roadmap for future presidents. Tell me what you meant by that.
One of the things that Republicans, Democrats, and people who study the presidency focus on in terms of making it difficult is the difficulty with transitions and the fact that that really, if you look at a private enterprise that had to have a merger between two companies as large as the federal government, they would take a year and a half or two to get it right. Presidents really have about a couple of months after they win before they have to take over. And the transition process, which they can't really start until they win, although they try to, sets them up for failure because you have this enormous period where you have to get people confirmed and then everybody kind of has to get on the playing field at the same time. And this president obviously has had a very chaotic personnel process, which has real costs when you talk to the experts about how you run a presidency. So the idea behind the Romney effort was to start the process very early, have basically a shadow government that worked through, okay, how would you take a piece of legislation that wants to do this, and how do we coordinate with the various different agencies, and how do we move as a team in preparation for when we actually go on the playing field in January? Now, he never got that opportunity, but the 600 or so people who worked on that effort kind of in parallel at the time with his presidential campaign set a pretty good model for the way to start the thinking about what governing looks like, its complexity, and start thinking that through. The Bush to Obama transition was also considered one that worked pretty well. It was Obama didn't do what Romney did in 2008, but the working between the two groups, the Obama team listened very closely to what the Bush team said on their way out. Because they recognized, although all incoming administrations are beset with a little overconfidence, but they nevertheless recognized these were some resources they could avail themselves of to help them with the new job they were going to do.
You know, I'd be remiss if I didn't acknowledge some of the questions popping up in the current moment. I mean, our conversation is predicated that the extraordinary for the president is now ordinary. But we live in extraordinary times, it seems to me, as we look at the presidency. You think about the fact that in the last 24 hours, questions have emerged, published, I believe, first by The New York Times, about what the special prosecutor wants to pose to President Trump himself. And they're wide-ranging. When you look at that list of questions, what do you see in terms of the interests of the special counsel? And how likely is it to absorb the president's time and concern?
Well, we don't know. And you're right. This is an extraordinary presidency. And part of what the piece is saying is that you have the extraordinary events of this presidency, which have nothing to do the extraordinary events of this president, which have nothing to do with the presidency. I mean, these are special, unique circumstances for this president. But there's also the way in which he participates in his office that illuminate a lot of these challenges with the presidency. And then you have the questions that are really agnostic on the specific president that still exist in the presidency. I think the Mueller questions, you know, well, first there's a sourcing question, which is where did these come from? And that's interesting because we certainly know about the games people play in leaking various information. But the set of questions look like what we would expect them to be, which is, you know, the questions of collusion and obstruction. And the most damning ones really are the obstruction-related questions, because that's the ones in which the president is at the center of the drama. And he is the one who is acting. Even in all the collusion conversation with the meetings with the president's son and a lawyer for the Russian government, which are obviously either, if they are not collusion, they are high interest and curiosity in the idea of collusion with the Russians, because that's how the meeting was set up. The president is not on stage in that conversation about collusion. But in obstruction, whether it has to do with Jeff Sessions or Michael Flynn or James Comey, he is center stage. And so those are the ones that are the most interesting, just in terms of going right at the president and his presidency.
I'd like to take a call now from St. Louis, Missouri. Mark, what's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I may be a little short-sighted, but I kind of trace some of this back to Mitch McConnell's statement when Mr. Obama took the presidency. It was that his Republican's job was to make sure he didn't get reelected. I mean, how can anybody run a business or a company when people you're supposed to be working with just refuse to work with you? So I think that's part of the problem with the current presidency.
It's a pointed point, John.
It's a great point. It's something I talk about in the article, and this is why the people who misunderstand and think that when you say the presidency is hard, it is an excuse for one president or another. They misunderstand, because when you talk about Mitch McConnell, in that case, that's something the Obama administration felt very keenly, which is they didn't have a willing partner in the Republican leadership of Congress. And it's why those analogies between Lyndon Johnson and any president, whether it's Bush, Obama or Trump, fall flat. If you think about Everett Dirksen, who was the Republican leader while Johnson was the president, Dirksen was a partner with President Johnson on a number of things. And obviously Mitch McConnell was not in that same, whether it was on nomination to the Supreme Court or on legislation. So one of the arguments about the difficulty with the presidency is the changing role of Congress. And so that would be a strong example. Both that comment about making President Obama one-term president, and also I find an even sharper analogy between Johnson's conversation in 1968 in the summer with Everett Dirksen about putting somebody on the Supreme Court, which Dirksen was all for, and Majority Leader McConnell and President Trump in an election year saying that Merrick Garland was not going to get on the court or even come up for a vote. That's directly opposite to what Everett Dirksen did in 1968 in a period that was later in an election year and in which Nixon looked like he was going to win.
Some of our listeners may know that you, John Dickerson, are also the force behind this terrific podcast, Whistle Stop, from Slate about campaigning with all kinds of arcana, deep dives, like crazy trivia. It's just great stuff. But you write in your piece about the fact that it feels like an eternal campaign. That is that presidents essentially appoint campaign aides to government jobs in heavy numbers, and that there's sort of the idea of the eternal campaign. How do you get out of that when that seems to be so fundamental to the political dynamic we now have?
Right. And Jimmy Carter tried to change that.
And how did that go for him, right?
Well, it's fascinating. The Carter presidency is fascinating because he tried to do a number of things that if you were sitting back and saying this would be a way to order a presidency based on sort of reason and the way you should operate. And they failed. Two failures would be one. He tried to tell his campaign team, look, you helped me get elected, but now I need a team in here to help me govern. And they revolted and they said no. And, and then he had lots of problems with a lot of those campaign folks who came to Washington thinking that they were outsiders and didn't really pay heed to members of Congress, including members of President Carter's own party. Second challenge was when he tried to delegate to his cabinet heads, and then found that when cabinet department heads feel like they're autonomous, they go off and do all kinds of things that cause you as the president political headaches. And so if you're going to get the headache for whatever your cabinet people do, then bring the power inside the White House, which makes some political sense, but it also, fills up your to-do list pretty quickly.
I'd like to see now if we can take one more call, I guess. We're getting a lot of folks who are talking to us a little bit about this president. So we can take Miriam from Sarasota, Florida. Miriam, we'd like to hear what you have to say.
Hi, David. Thanks for taking the call. I think every president has extraordinary and exceptional challenges. The expectation, however, is that you put someone in that position who is willing to access the institutions that hold this country together. We have a man sitting in the White House right now who has decided that he is not going to use those institutions to their best advantage. He is undermining and totally incapable of taking that presidency and looking for the best possible ways to take his responsibility for the American people and for the world.
Thank you, Miriam, for that. John, let's take a test case right now. We've got talks going on in North Korea, which the president certainly, I've gotten calls from all kinds of conservative friends in recent days saying, you know, well, what about, you know, gosh, is he going to get a Nobel Prize for this? He seems to have encouraged the leaders of the Koreas to meet, which is really a signal moment. I don't think we've seen that in almost two decades. You know, what do you think he's going to be able to convene here, and how substantive do you think it's possible something's going to emerge?
It's a great question. Just one quick point on the difference between presidents and their presidencies. I think one of the challenges in our politics of the moment, and that I write about, and that is something we have to get beyond, is it is possible to have opinions about a thing that is happening in front of you and still have opinions about the larger presidency. So this is an institution that's over 200 years old, and the thinking about only presidents and presidencies as the same thing is a kind of presentism and momentary thinking that is certainly called for, but it is not the only kind of thinking called for, because what happens then is you don't think about the institutions, how to improve them, what challenges come from the institutions and what challenges come from the president. And unless you pull those two things apart, you just repeat the same mistakes over and over again about our expectations for a president and how those are mismatched with what a president can actually do.
And the briefest of statements on North Korea.
On North Korea, we'll have to see how it turns out in the end. He has gotten something to happen that previous presidents have tried to do and have not. But there have been negotiations with North Korea before and they have not borne fruit. So the end will tell.
All right, fair enough. You just heard the voice of John Dickerson. He's co-anchor of CBS This Morning, contributing editor of The Atlantic Magazine. John, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, David.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website at onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. Track us down at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, top trade American trade officials are set to negotiate in Beijing. How will China take Trump's tough trade talk? How much alliteration are you going to be able to expect from me? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.